So this is the third talk in the series on anatta, self and non-self. And I could maybe entitle this talk, "If Everything Changes, Then Whose Back Is Hurting?" And we discussed it a little bit this morning. If we get close to experience, it begins to break down. And we see that it's constantly changing, moving, and dynamic. Anicca. That applying mindfulness allows the truth of the dynamic life to emerge, instead of a kind of summary that we're making all the time, linking things together and making kind of one collection out of our experience, which is not at all a collection. It's in pieces. It passes. A thought is one thing. We don't usually experience a thought as one unit that arises and passes. We usually experience thought as a whole stream, a narrative, a tasrit, a film script that just goes on and on and on and comes to various conclusions on the way, which are usually rather uncomfortable. But if we look carefully, it's made of packets. A beginning and an end. The body seems to be one thing, an object. When we look carefully, we see that it's actually dynamic and flowing and changing. It's made of many, many changing energies and impressions and cells and pieces, and it never the same. For 1 minute to the next, if we really look carefully. In other words, it's not a thing. And this already frees us, because we find ourselves living in a much less constructed and imprisoned world, which is made of change and freedom. The nature of the world and our experience and our place in it is so dynamic and free in its nature. And it's all very well, but what upsets us is that we really don't like to change. There's something in us that actually resists it. We're fine until we get sick. Then we blame the medical world, we blame our body, we blame viruses, we blame poor little bacteria, chaydakim, that are just doing their life. And we resist like hell any change. And so there's something very deep in us that actually doesn't want to know the dynamic nature of reality. It's frightening. If everything's changing, then what have I got to hold on to? If I don't know if really I'll be different in the next 10 minutes, then who am I? I need to depend on a solid me that I recognize from moment to moment. I need to know what's going to happen tomorrow. If I don't know what's going to happen tomorrow because everything's changing, I feel the world will go to pieces. So there is a kind of a fear, and we're not ready for that. But it's a problem, because if we're not ready to see the truth of the way things are dynamic and flowing, then we're living in illusion, and it's painful. Conditions change. So everything changes when conditions change. our experience in this retreat is a change from the experiences that we had before we came here. We put ourselves in different conditions and our experiences are completely different. And next Monday afternoon, many of us are going to say, oh my God, how am I going to go back to Tel Aviv? It's going to be so difficult. I'm living here in an island. It's been so peaceful, it's been so loving, it's been so quiet, it's been so aware, and it's been so interesting. Now I've got to go back into this mess, forgetting there's just conditions. Tel Aviv is a condition, the retreat is a condition, the next moment is created by conditions. The conditions are created by conditions. There isn't anything that's not created by conditions. And if conditions create other conditions that create other conditions, then it means all we are is a bunch of conditions. We're not anything. We're just a bunch of conditions making more conditions. Na'im making more na'im. So that who is me? Many, many conditions have come together to make this object. This object. Many, many conditions. Someone did it. Someone made it. The metal that is dug up from the earth by poor, miserable Chinese workers. The shop that sold it, the person that's put it together, the thoughts of the person that's put it together, the thoughts of the man that invented this thing, the thing that is here now in relationship to me and to you, making a certain function. And all the world is needed to make this thing happen right now where it is. The whole universe of conditions creates this thing here, or this thing there, or you here, or me here. The whole universe is needed for everything to be there. So, including and, I would say, vital to this whole understanding is that one of the places where conditions are created, and the big place, is in the mind. Because this thing, as we see it, as a thing, a microphone, can only exist as it is if we here regard it as a microphone and are interested in it as a microphone and define it as a microphone. Who can define the piece of air above the microphone? What's it called? Who made it? Even this microphone, who can define that piece of it? Or this bit of it? Or this bit of it? Who can say what it is? Who can say what's interesting about it? Who can say anything about it? So our descriptions and definitions are as much part of the conditions that make the world and make ourselves as anything materials in the world itself. And especially what we're interested in, what we've learnt to describe as things and define as things. It's a learnt process. It's in the mind. It's in awareness. So the world is created by our awareness. And this is troubling and frightening if we're not ready for it. And it's liberating. And if you just think how much solidity and truth we give to a painful narrative in the mind, a painful story that keeps coming up for us. A disturbing story that goes on and on, such as, I'm no good, I can't succeed at things, or I'm afraid of them out there who want to kill me or throw me into the sea, or anything you like. Stories in the mind seem to take on a reality because we forget how much we create them from conditions that have arisen in our life, from voices that have come into us from our childhood, from other people, from the world. We then own them. We then become interested in them. They become the major player in our life, and they take on solidity and reality. If we look at them a bit more carefully, with intimacy, they're just made of conditions like everything else. And they come and they go. And they seem very, very solid. Guilt. Anger at something. Blame ourselves or other seemed real. Of course I should blame. It's obviously they've done wrong or I've done wrong, I should blame. It has no reality. It's a thought that is made of conditions. So we can free ourselves with a sense of the dynamic nature of things, our views. And one of the beautiful aspects of Dharma practice is that we don't actually need to fight problems and issues that come up for us. We don't need to sit here with a kind of a gun, and up pops a negative thought, bang, got to get rid of you. Up pops another thought, blame, oh, no good, I've got to get rid of you. Bang, bang, shoot them down, because they're not helpful. I want to free myself of this, I want to free myself of that. Shoot. And the truth is that if we just look carefully, everything goes by itself. So we actually don't need to get rid of anything. And it's just hard for people to really see that, but if you practice, and if you practice seriously, it always arises as a understanding that things pass by themselves. We're not made of them. They're dynamic, they're free, they flow by. You don't need to get rid of anything. It gets rid of itself. But we have to know that as experience. We have to know that in our flesh. It's not enough to know that as a concept or as an idea. The movement to freedom has to be felt in our bones and seen absolutely clearly in our flesh. And that's why we sit here day after day after day, doing some hard work sometimes. But if we just begin to see that, it can be something very, very gross and like a pain in the body or tiredness that arises. If we look at it carefully, we see it's made of change. It passes and flows. It is not really us. It is a condition that arises because of other conditions. If we really see that carefully and intimately, we're already free. And then the next time that something comes up that gives us trouble, it's easier. The next story that comes that gives us a headache, the next view that comes that troubles us, we see, wait a minute, it just flies by like a bird in the sky. So I mentioned this morning about three characteristics. And I mentioned just now anicca, changeability. The second is dukkha, pain, painfulness or non-satisfactory nature of life. And the first noble truth of the Buddha, sabbe sankhara dukkha. All constructions are painful, are difficult for us. You might think, well, wait a minute, what's this Buddha talking about? I mean, life is great, I'm having a great time. What's all this pain and suffering story? I'm enjoying my life and don't need, you know, I get up in the morning late, I have a cup of coffee, I go out in the street, I enjoy myself, go to the pub in the evening. What's all this? But if we look at it carefully, we can see that living inside an illusory world that's constructed and formed and fixed gives us pain and trouble. Because it's illusion. It's not real. So we find ourselves bumping into the walls. We don't want change. We don't want to lose. It's fine to go to the pub in the evening until the pub shuts down, or until our girlfriend or boyfriend fights us, or until we get a virus, or until we get old and pubs don't interest us anymore, or until God knows any change that happens in our life. And dukkha is not only ordinary suffering and pain and loss, which we all experience, and death, we all experience. It's not only that. It's also sankhara dukkha, the dukkha of conditioning. The fact that we are living in a constructed world, that we've defined everything according to our experience. This and this and this and this is all fixed according to what we learnt and according to what's in the brain. So our brain is constructed to see this and ourselves and so on. And so where's the freedom? Because our brain is constructed by the world is constructed by our brain. So where's the freedom? And that can be a painful realization that we are kind of in a circle, like in the Kabbalah, when the image of a human being is of a hamster or gear that's going round in a wheel, or of a jar, insects in a jar. Harakim in a tinsenet, insects in a jar that are climbing up and falling down and climbing up and falling down and climbing up and falling down. Rather uncomfortable image. But that is sankhara dukkha, the dukkha of living in a conditioned world, a constructed world that we construct. And it's living inside structure. It's living in an automatic way. It's swept by the tides. And a lot of it is us. Is we are making that sankhara dukkha out of the events that happen to us in our life. You know, there's a famous Buddhist story of the arrow and the second arrow, where someone was hit by an arrow, and it hurt, and it fell down. But then he took the arrow and he began to stab himself again and again and again. The second arrow, the third arrow. The first arrow, it hurt. The second arrow is, why did it happen to me? The third arrow is, I must kill somebody because of it. The fourth arrow is, it's always happening to me. I'm no good. Life is no good. Life is terrible. It's full of shit. Arrow after arrow. He stabs himself, instead of just letting the first arrow go down and finished. So, the dukkha is the second and the third and the fourth arrow. And it's very subtle. It's very subtle. It can get very subtle. We're sitting here so peaceful and quiet. And then all of a sudden, we don't know why, we didn't do anything, we mind our own business, and our back hurts, our body hurts, we have to move. Nothing wrong with that, but we can take a lesson there, that at that moment, dukkha arises, it's not enough. It's not good enough, this stillness. It only lasted 10 minutes. We're not like my cat, that can sit 3 hours in an armchair without moving, totally happy, and doesn't no apparent dukkha. I'm trying to ask my cat, you know, where's your dukkha? And just sits there in total bliss. So we are holding on to things that change. And when it changes, we feel uncomfortable. And we have to do something about it. And one of the places that can already free us with dukkha is that dukkha is not personal. We shouldn't take it all personally. It's a rather impersonal process. That it comes because we're constructed beings. We're made of other things. We're made of other things. I'll talk about this later. So, of course, if we're constructed by life, we also go to pieces again. What to do? It's impersonal. Samsara, the wheel of life, is impersonal. The dukkha we feel is not really personal. It's just arrived through conditions. And that can really help us. It can reduce the arrows that we're using to hurt ourselves with. We say, okay, I don't need to pick up this arrow. Anyway, it came to me from the outside. Anyway, it came from somewhere else. I don't have to take it personally. Dukkha is there. And that's a great help in our life. We don't need to take it on our shoulders all the time. And it's possible to be free inside dukkha. Because dukkha is a response in our awareness. And our awareness is basically free. And it's an important point. Our awareness doesn't have a problem. Our awareness is just aware. Our awareness is in its nature free and empty. And then it fits itself into packets called me, or objects, or world. It builds worlds, but the material with which the worlds are built is empty and free. Awareness, can anyone say that awareness is a thing? Awareness is just the quality of knowing that fits itself into anything that we look at. So I'm looking at this paper. My free awareness, which is like water, which is like air, is collected and captured by this piece of paper, and then the awareness says, there's a piece of paper. But the awareness itself is free. Meaning, if the awareness is free, then we are already free. It's like the ocean is free, but it keeps putting itself into bottles. What to do? Just remember that the ocean is water, and everything is water, and nothing is in bottles. There's a nice quote from the Sutta Nipata about this. And the Buddha was asked, is there a place really where I can find safety, where I can find the end of all the difficulty of life, the dukkha? And he says, yes. For the sake of those people stuck in the middle of the river of being, overwhelmed by death and difficulty, I will tell you where to find solid ground. There is an island. An island which you cannot go beyond. It's a place of nothingness. A place of non-possession, of non-attachment. It's the total end of death and difficulty. And it is why I call it Nibbana. The extinguished, the gone out, what's gone out. There are people who, with mindfulness, have realized this and are completely gone out here and now. They do not become slaves working for Mara, for death. They cannot fall into its power. The third of the three characteristics that I mentioned this morning is anatta. And it's often mistakenly called no self, and with a kind of a subtext that there is no self. But that's not really true. Because, like I said, we all experience a subject. The subject is looking out of our eyes at me, and I'm a subject looking out of my eyes at you. So clearly there is an experience of a subject. So it's translated as non-self, an-atta, non-self, not no-self. And it means that there is no enduring, means staying, self as a thing, that there is no thinness in the experience of self. It has no thinness. And that's what the island of safety, island which you cannot go beyond, it's a place of no-thingness. Nothingness, no thingness. And it's not only about me and you, it's about all objects. It's about, just because I define this thing and I happen to see this thing without looking carefully and mindfully as an object, it seems to us to be a thing. It seems to have a kind of a self or an identity. But if we look carefully, there is no thingness about this. It is a dynamic process in the middle of its changing reality. It's made of conditions that are moving to other conditions. And the same with this. So, sometimes anatta is equated, is taken to mean emptiness. And this can be taking it too far. Because the Buddha didn't talk that much about emptiness. Because it tends to turn into a object. So instead of a self, which is a big problem, we replace it with emptiness, which is another big problem. What am I going to do with this thing called emptiness? I have to deal with that. It's bad enough dealing with me. Now I've got to deal with emptiness as well. So, I want to be careful here because emptiness is not empty of meaning. It has its role. It has its understanding. There is a reason why the word emptiness, sunyata, exists, and it has a certain direction. And especially in the Tibetan tradition, it's taken as a very, very important essence. But the Buddha and the authority of the Buddha to our practice here is much more, about the unfindability of the self, the transparency of the self, shakuf. Because the truth is that we are under the illusion that we are somebody. And not only us, but my cat as well. And every other being as well. And in the tradition, there is a word for this called ahamkara and amankara. Ahamkara is I making. The making of an I. The construction of I. And amankara is the construction of mine. Mine. And every ant will have that going on inside them. If you take an ant away from its path, its home, it will desperately try and get back to its nest. How does it know that? Because it's mine. It knows that's my home, not there. And so all beings experience ahamkara and amankara. And you could almost say that the I-making and the mind-making is the reason that beings are born. They are born and survive as part of an I-making process. They are making me in order to survive. And we need to have that. A child that doesn't have a good, nice, solid mechanism called me is in trouble. is all the time, their whole life going to psychologists trying to look for a me. And mostly psychologists can't even deal with that kind of problem because the psychologists need a me to relate to sit opposite to. They need to have another me in the chair opposite. If there's no me in the chair opposite, the psychologists don't know what to do. And actually it can be quite painful for children and for adults that have less than me than is healthy. So the me-making, the I-making, is not a problem. It's part of the nature and part of survival. How can I cross the road and not get run over by a bus if I don't have a center that tells me what to do when I'm standing on the edge of the road? If my arm tells me, you can go there, and my other arm says, you go there, and my head says, you go there, and my mind says, you go there, I won't last 5 minutes. Especially with egged bus drivers. We need a good, healthy mechanism of ahamkara and amankara. But that doesn't mean to say we need to be controlled by it. We need a good mechanism of self-creation, just like we need a good mechanism for the digestion of our lunch. We need a good marechet ikul, digestive system. We need a good sense of ahamkara and amankara. But that's all. We don't need to turn it into this whole control system that controls everything we do in our life and puts us in prison. So, ata and anata means selfing and non-selfing is a verb, not a thing. It's shem poel velo shem etzem. I am right now Stevening myself in front of you, and you're giving me permission for that. So, the Stevening that's happening right now here, you're part of it, because we are giving each other recognition, a sense of being with each other, knowing each other. It's a verb. It's an experience. Self. It's not an essence. It's an expression. And we can notice it not by itself. We can't see the self that easily. It's difficult to see the self. But we can see it through its expression. So, for example, expression of agency, meaning I am the origin of my actions. I am doing this. That's agency. That way we experience the self. I am moving my hand. Movement is happening and the source of it is me. Or the decision behind it is me. So, agency is a way we can notice the self. Agency, control. We might ask ourselves, who is in charge of the breath? Who's breathing? It's control. And it's a question. Is it free? Is it coming by itself? Is it doing itself? Am I doing it? It's a question. We can look at it. We might notice control is happening. I can breathe short or long. I can stop for a little bit. And then I'm no longer in control. We can experience the self through being a subject. Things are happening to me. Apparently, if someone talks to me, I experience that the words are coming to me and I collect the words. They don't come past me. And Sahar says, Stephen, and I look, who are you talking to? I collect things happening to me, and so I'm a vessel. An experience being a vessel called a subject. and a subject has objects. So it's a center. I'm being a center. And this centering, this sense of center, is a way we experience self. But it's an experience. It's not a thing. I experience ownership. Balut. And I've told this story before, so excuse me for those that know it, but it's just such a funny story. That one time, I was trying hard, and of course failing, to learn Hebrew at the University of Haifa. And I used to go every morning to the University of Haifa to Ulpan. And I still have a white Subaru station. And I parked it there. And when I went out, I saw a white Subaru there, but it wasn't mine. And I realized that what happened is my white Subaru has been stolen, but there was another white Subaru next to it that wasn't mine, that wasn't stolen. And I thought to myself, well, if the other Subaru had been stolen, I wouldn't have had two thoughts about it. But it, because my white Subaru was stolen, ooh, I mean, they stole my car. And they were two exactly the same. There was one belonged to somebody else, one belonged to me. Mine got stolen, and I cry. The other gets stolen. I don't care. The act is the same. The ownership makes a difference. It was quite funny. My car, myself, my children. I wonder how many actually children, especially when they grow up a bit, like to be thought of as my children. Someone is saying, my children. I mean, children don't like that very much because they see a bit more truth. They don't like to be owned. Boundaries is another area where we can feel the expression of self. We can see the self. So I have an intuition that my self finishes here. And here is not me. But here is me. Or here is me. Or is it here? But is it here or is it here? Or what about here? Where exactly do I finish? What about here? What about here? What about? We have an issue of boundary. We have a definition of where we end and where we begin. This is built in from a very early age. A child playing with toys is playing and understanding boundary, where the body finishes and where the objects begin. But it isn't, again, a thing. It's an experience. I must say I had a very interesting experience quite recently, six months ago, when I put myself in a laboratory in Bar-Ilan University, and they were doing some experiments on meditators. And they asked me to go into meditation, put various sensors and cheshanim and so on, magnetic sensors to measure the brain. And someone who's actually a friend of mine, Dr. Yochai Ataria, he began to ask me many, many questions. Now, the experience that they were looking for was the experience of self expressed as boundary and boundarylessness. The experience of having no boundary. The experience of no boundary is an experience basically of infinity, Ein Sof. That there isn't any boundary means there's no end to the experience. The experience doesn't finish here or here. No boundary at all. Experience of limitlessness. So he asked me to go into various boundary states and limitlessness. And this is all half an hour. That's all it took, or an hour. And last two or three weeks ago, I received in the mail a 30-page scientific paper with all the questions he asked me while I was in meditation and the answers I gave of the experience that I was experiencing at that time. And it was all written in this scientific, semi-scientific, psychological way. It was amazing. I was shocked to see it in this. It was 30 pages of details, how each part of the experience was expressed and so on. And it was quite an extraordinary paper, actually, and a brilliant, brilliant research, which is very unusual because usually people in laboratories do test meditators and Buddhist monks and so on. There's quite a few hundreds of sort of research papers, but very, very rarely do you get such fine, sensitive questions and answers about the experience, the details of the experience, what happens during states of mind. And this was all about boundary and boundarylessness, and was really interesting. So we recognize the self also through identity, of course. I'm Israeli, I'm this, I'm Jewish. Personal identity, group identity. I remember really struggling with my father, who was Orthodox Jewish. And I kept asking him, where am I Jewish? Obviously, you know, I have circumcision. But that doesn't really, it still doesn't feel Jewish. So is this a Jewish finger? I mean, where is the Jewishness? Show me where Jewishness is. Of course he couldn't. It's a thought. Again, the self as an experience, not as a thing, as a label. So we all use this language. Oh, I'm Jewish, I'm not Jewish, you're Jewish, we're Jewish, or we're Pakistani, or we're... But it's just a label, and it's also very, very confused. We can decide we're Jewish, but I can decide I'm English, or I can decide I'm Greybeard, or I can decide I'm a grandfather, or I can decide I'm all these roles, I'm loads of them. I can't even count them. There's thousands of identities that are built into this thing here. I was just showing the other teachers and a picture, which I'm kind of quite happy that you can't see it. It's quite far. So don't look too carefully. But here's a picture of that I found in a book of myself at a psychedelic festival 50 years ago. And almost nobody could recognize that it was me. I asked people, who's that? And they didn't know. And it's 50 years ago, at the beginning of the hippie revolution. And there I was, sort of one of the early hippies, at a rock festival. And this came out in a book. And it looks so interesting. Is this person me? If we look closely at the truth of anatta, it's very confusing, it's very unfindable. And here is a clue and a help to us. And it's interesting that when we discuss this in the two groups today, sitting on the grass, in both groups, I had more than one person questioning, saying that they were very confused because when the self appeared in different shapes and was very confusing. For example, someone said, I have this experience here, but I also have the experience of wanting to change that experience, to make it better, to soften it, to heal it. I have tension and I want to heal it. So is the tension expressing me, but then is the intention to heal it also me? So where Where is what? And someone else was talking about, I feel myself in front of myself and then behind myself. I'm not sure where I am. So one of the places that is helpful to us is what you might call a healthy confusion. Bilbul bari. And we can see how the experience of self not being a thing means that we can receive it in multiple ways. It's more of a pasifas. It's more of a mosaic, a kaleidoscope. We regard the self as a kaleidoscope. So every time the conditions, you know, kaleidoscope, you move it and all the colors change. So every time we move a little bit, the conditions change. We also change. And don't try and see the self as in a linear way, like, I know this self. It's a field of change. It's transparent. Shakuf. One of the definitions of anatta that Stephen Batchelor uses is in his books is transparency. It's a mental construct. It comes and goes. When we go to sleep at night, finished self. We can dream a bit, but there's a very, very strange self usually comes out in the dreams. We can't recognize that one. One time, a yogi asked the Buddha, a sadhu, Vachagota, and said, Gotama, Buddha, is there a self? And when this was said, the Buddha remained silent. So, Master Gotama, I suppose there's no self. The second time, the Buddha was silent. And then, Vachagota rose from his seat and departed. After he'd left, Ananda said to the Buddha, why is it, sir, that when you were questioned by the wanderer Vachagota, you did not answer? And the Buddha said, if, Ananda, when I was asked by the wanderer Vachagota, is there a self? And I had answered, there is a self. This would have been siding or supporting all those who are eternalists, who think that there are things in the world forever, that exist forever. And if, when I was asked by him, there is no self, is there no self? And I would answer, there is no self. This would have been helping the view of those who believe in nothing, that nothing exists. If I had answered, there is a self, would this have been consistent with the arising of the knowledge that all phenomena are non-self? No. And if, when I was asked, is there no self, I had answered, there is no self, the wanderer who was already confused would have fallen into greater confusion, thinking, it seems that the self that I formerly was now doesn't exist anymore. So kind of the Buddha said, best to stay silent when asked this question, is there a self or is there no self? Because it comes and goes as an experience. It's wrong to say there is no self, and it's wrong to say there is a self. Both of them would lead to views. There is a self would lead to views that there is things in the world that are solid and forever eternalist in the word in English. And no self would lead to sense nothingness, nothing exists. If I don't exist and the world doesn't exist, it's all a great nothingness. Also not true. So in our life, we need to experience these three characteristics constantly, repeatedly. We need to see the endings and the beginnings of things. We need to see how the self arises, how it's more or less. We need to notice how when someone shouts at us, we have a very strong self. We react. We defend ourselves. and we feel a very strong subject. When we're blissed out, lying down, spaced out, relaxed, like my cat, as they say, not much self, fine, don't need to be anybody special. We need to see all the three characteristics. We need to see dukkha, we need to see anicca, we need to see the impersonal nature of things. We need to let go a lot, to see things as they are and as they disappear. And all three of them are connected. Because we are believing we are a solid self, a lot of the dukkha arises. A lot of the pain arises because we keep defending ourselves. We keep struggling in life. We keep trying to be a better person. We keep worrying about things. We keep trying to understand what will be better for me next week, next year. We're all the time busy with the self. So we believe the self and it creates dukkha. So therefore, atta creates dukkha. The two are connected. A Zen, a very little short, spicy Zen phrase says, why do we suffer? It's because 99% of everything that gives us trouble happens to us, and there isn't one. So I'll finish with a small poem by Rumi, which I've shortened slightly, and it's called, and it's very relevant to our practice right now. And the poem is called In Every Breath. In every breath, if you're the center of your own desires, you'll lose the grace of the divine. But if in every breath you blow away your self-importance, the ecstasy of love will soon arrive. In every breath, if you're the center of your own thoughts, the sadness of autumn will fall on you. But if in every breath you strip naked, just like a winter, the joy of spring will grow from within. All your impatience comes from the push for gain, for your needs. Let go of the effort and peace will arrive. Let's take a couple of minutes.